You're listening to the ESP, the European Skeptics Podcast, an independent weekly show set out to bring you news, interesting topics and interviews with people mostly from Europe, building bridges and breaking down language barriers to show the world how active and awesome the skeptical movement is in the region. This is episode 417. I'm your host, András Pintér, and joining me for the show are my co-hosts, Annika Harrison and Pontus Böckmann. Sziasztok!
Hallo!
Hey son, guys! Time again for another episode.
And two shows in a row with all three of us present? Oh my yes. God, what's happening?
Yeah, we're very strange. Unprecedented. But fortunately, it's not just the three of us. We do get some listener feedback, though. It's good mm-hmm. to
which
know.
Which we love.
Mm-hmm. Yes, even though now we got a correction, and we love corrections because we hate being wrong. And maybe it's two corrections, I'm not quite sure. We'll see. But 2 weeks ago, I talked about the fossil of a Tridentinosaurus antiquus, which is, or rather was, famous for its preservation of soft tissue, which is, as we discussed, rather unusual and rare. The fossil was discovered way back in 1931. But a few weeks ago, a researcher called Valentina Rossi showed that the soft tissue that was apparently showing on this famous fossil was actually fake, and it had been added using paint probably a long time ago, around the time when it was found, well, after it was found, I guess, but before it was really investigated properly. But back to the correction. At the time, I commented on the name of the fossil, and I sort of translated it on the fly, the word Tridentinosaurus. I translated it as three-toothed lizard or something to that effect. But one may wonder, why would a creature only have three teeth? That is very unusual, I would say. That should have raised a red flag for me. And listener Francesca from Italy wrote in and pointed out that the specimen was not at all named after the number of teeth that it had. It was named after the place where it was found, which is the province of Trento, or Trent in English. Trento was in the Roman days known as Tridentum, and that's where the fossil got its name from. So thank you very much, Francesca. I stand corrected. Or do I? The plot thickens. We love languages on this podcast, and this time I want to make sure that I do my homework. And if we are to believe Wikipedia, and I think in this case we can take its word for it, I wasn't entirely wrong when it comes to the etymology. I quote from Wikipedia now. The Latin name given to the settlement was Tridentum, meaning three-teeth place, or trident town, from tree, meaning three, and dens, or dent, which means tooth.
Yeah. So the city is called Three Teeth.
yes, or the province. Mm-hmm. So my old Latin skills did not fail me entirely, but the reason for why the lizard had the name wasn't right. It was from where it was found, not because of the number of the teeth.
So your deduction was correct, but your result wasn't.
Yeah, which happens to people.
The best of times, yes.
Actually,
yeah.
That you probably know that a trident or trident is also a tool. It's a three-pronged spear.
Poseidon.
Yeah.
Poseidon.
Neptune. Neptune, if we're talking Latin. Yes, okay, that's right. I didn't think of that.
Or the father of Ariel in The Little Mermaid. Yeah, so he had that too.
That's right. Yeah, that's very good. But speaking of corrections, I'm not quite done yet, because I referred several times in the same news item to dinosaurs. But the fossil is older than the dinosaurs. And I actually mentioned that, but I still called it a dinosaur, sort of. And in fact, it is classified as a reptile, not a dinosaur. So again, thank you very much, Francesca, for the correction. We always welcome it when our listeners know more than we do. And we really don't want to spread misinformation that sort of defeats the purpose of the podcast. So if anybody catches us making mistakes like this, we always welcome it when you let us know. And the easiest way, of course, is to send us an email at info@theesp.eu, because every time you do that, we learn something new.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just one more thing to add to that.
Yeah.
Dinosaurs were reptiles. It's a larger category. It's a higher level of taxonomy. So dinosaurs are reptiles, but not all reptiles are dinosaurs. So this is why you were wrong.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, when it comes to the number three, there is a very famous species or genus of dinosaurs, Triceratops.
Of course, yes.
The three-horned one. That is very famous. Yeah, just an interesting fact. Okay.
Yes.
Again, thanks very much for the feedback. We love feedback, and we like not only correctional kind of feedback, we really love the positive things as well. Like when you just leave a positive review or a comment, or you just rate us with 5 stars on one of the podcast's downloading applications. So please feel free to do that if you like the show, because that helps us reaching a larger audience. And that's always a good thing for everyone who produces content.
Yeah.
Which we are here to do. So
yes.
why don't we turn to that? And as usual, we're going to start the show with something that we call Twish, also known as This Week in Skeptical History. This week's Skeptical History item will be something that is more along the lines of science history, but it has connections to skepticism as well. We are commemorating the birth of a person who went by the name, and I'm trying to pronounce the Flemish name correctly, Gerardus Mercator.
Ah.
We probably have Flemish listeners, so please feel free to send in the proper pronunciation as an audio recording, and we will be happy to play it on the next episode. So, but the funny thing is about this, a fun fact, is that I did Google the proper pronunciation of his name. What the results came up about were the English pronunciation, and people claim that that is the correct pronunciation, and it goes like Gerardus Mercator, which is definitely not the Flemish pronunciation. And
don't use other languages, speak normal like English people.
Yeah, it's like, come on, don't be that ignorant. So the place where he was born on the 5th of March, 1512, was called Rupemonde in the county of Flanders. So that was a long time ago. And does his name sound familiar to you?
Yes.
Okay.
To me, it does. But I don't know if he is the guy, because I know that Well, I know that when you look at the map of the world, that you sometimes talk about a Mercator projection or Mercator projection.
Projection, yeah.
And I wonder if that's the same guy.
It's the same guy.
Ah.
So he was a geographer, a cartographer, and we call him a cosmographer as well, because he was really excited about the cosmos and understanding astronomical phenomena as well. He was also one of the first people who really came up with viable ideas regarding geomagnetism phenomena. So the world map that he drew in 1569, or finished rather in 1569, is still basically in use today. I mean, details of it have been changed, but what he used was that certain projection. And it's a projection of the surface of a sphere. The points on the surface of the sphere are projected onto a cylindrical surface, so that basically it flattens out the whole surface out, which you cannot do with the surface.
So he was a flat earther then?
He was a flat earther. Oh my God, that
the
didn't...
first and only true flat earther.
And he indeed he was. So, but so the problem was that lots of navigational maps that had been used up until his new projection were a little bit off or difficult to use for those who wanted to do the navigation itself. So the lines of the geographical network, we know that we have longitudinal and latitudinal lines, that there are not real lines, but we have certain points on the surface of the Earth that we attribute to those lines. So that gives the basis of cartography, and navigation is basically built on all that. So his projection was so important because it basically made the whole matrix of these lines, the whole lines and the distances between the lines looked the same on the map. So it was easier to relate to, it was easier to work with in everyday navigational tasks. So that was a huge undertaking that he did. And he was also a builder of certain astronomical equipment, including globes. That was a big hit. He manufactured globes, and his clients were all over the place. Like, there were several high-ranking politicians, dukes, and at some point, even the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. So he was quite a guy. So when you said if it was the guy, yes, he was the guy for a lot of people. And the basis of the current projections. So if you go on Google Earth, the basis of the projections that we see are basically his projections. There are problems with it. For example, if you look at that map, you will see distortions in the sizes of the continents. And that is because the further you go from the equator, the more the distortion will be, because things will be blown out of proportion. So it's like the sizes will be completely enlarged, the places that are closer to the equator. One great example is Greenland, the size of Greenland, because if you look at the map or the projection of the current very accurate maps, it looks like Greenland is almost the same size as Africa.
Yeah, this is the example, right?
Whereas in reality, Africa is about 15 times larger than Greenland. Yeah. So it's a ridiculous distortion of sizes, but still it can be used. I mean, it's usable, but there are other consequences of this. If you have ever flown overseas and was following the map while flying over continents, you see a weird thing happening. Like, there is a curvature to the actual trajectory, and you say that, why are we taking the longer road? It's not, but it's the projection of you flying over the surface of a curved surface, which is that of the Earth. It's really great. But why he probably has a little bit of a skeptical angle for his life as well is that, first of all, he was involved a little bit with astrology as well. But back then, it wasn't uncommon. It wasn't unheard of. A lot of other people were involved in astrology, including Johannes Kepler, who was the court astronomer in Prague. And he was a very devout Christian. And I didn't say Catholic because it was around the time of Martin Luther's teachings gaining ground across Europe. And he was one of the people who really sympathized with those teachings. And he got into trouble because of that. So much so that at some point he was imprisoned in Leuven. And then, unfortunately, he had to spend a couple of months in prison, but he was very fortunate compared to some others who got imprisoned at the same time as he did, because some of those people were tortured and executed, and some other people were just expelled. He was supposed to go through that same thing, but he was released, and then later on, he found that probably as a former convict, he could not really stay in Leuven. So he moved to current-day Germany, to Duisburg, and that's where he spent the last couple of decades of his life teaching, mostly astronomy. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And selling globes to the emperor.
And selling globes. And selling globes, which is really a big hit. The fun thing was that they are called gores, the little pieces of paper that they drew the parts of the continents on, and they covered about 30 degrees of the surface of the Earth, and they were glued to the globe itself. It's still the technique used.
It's still how you do it.
Yeah. When it comes to, well, you can now 3D print them, but when it's a paper surface globe that you use, it's still how they make it. So it's really cool, I think. And he was known to be a very nice and very moderate guy. And yet he left behind something that has still a huge effect on our everyday life. It's unbelievable.
And it's also interesting because I know of the Mercator projection and of our guy Mercator because of critics of that.
Yeah.
They claim that this would perpetuate a Eurocentric view of the world because Africa is like significantly larger than it appears and smaller than Europe, and they think that it contributes to a sense of Africa being less significant or less important.
Well, unless you take the effort and look up the sizes of the continents, yes. The real sizes.
No, but it's like the first thing you see. It's like, yeah, exactly. I can understand what they mean, because if you think of a map, you usually think of that.
Yeah.
Because it's what you see in the school books, for example. But we should keep in mind that Mercator did that because it was practical. It wasn't political what he did there.
And he did know that it was flawed.
Yes.
And there are other projections. So for certain different tasks, you can use other projections. But for everyday tasks, mm-hmm. it's still the one that we go for.
Mm.
By the way, it has another implication, and that is the size of Russia, which happens to be the largest mm-hmm. country on Earth, but not by the proportions that we see on the map. So, yeah, that's another thing about that, because it's further to the north. That's the reason why. All right. So, yeah, let's celebrate him and his work on the occasion that his birthday is on the 5th of March. So he was born in 1512, and he died at a very high age of 82, which was in that mm-hmm. time really considered super high. So really cool. And please let us know how to pronounce his name properly. I don't know. Gerardus or something. But I'm not sure. Okay. So moving on to the news.
Over the last couple of years, of course, the political situation in Europe has deteriorated massively following, of course, the attack on Ukraine by Russia. And obviously, this is not a local event. It has repercussions in all of Europe and beyond that as well. The risk of the conflict spreading is very real, and no country in Europe is as safe as it used to be. Even traditionally neutral Sweden has abandoned its very old policy and almost in panic decided to join NATO, which turned out to be a very lengthy and complicated process. But it,
sorry about that.
Yeah, fine. I'm sure you didn't do it on purpose, Andras. But no, even Hungary last week approved Sweden as a new member of NATO. And now it's just a question of sending the paper to the US, I think. Anyway, there are people out there that see an opportunity of this kind of unrest to capitalize on people's fears. There is a government body in Sweden called the Swedish Civil Contingencies Agency, which is abbreviated MSB in Swedish. I won't go into the etymology of that, but MSB I will call it from now on. This agency presents themselves on their website like this. Quote, the Swedish Civil Contingencies Agency, MSB, is responsible for helping society prepare for major accidents, crises, and the consequences of war. Our work is led by a director general appointed by the Swedish government. End quote. So it's an official body. Now, MSB has noticed a huge uptake in the marketing of very questionable products lately,
mm-hmm.
often trying to implicate MSB to make it seem more credible. And MSB is not happy about this. And in fact, they said in their own words, they are quote unquote pissed off. And the translation is mine, but take my word for it. That's what they said. Many companies is now selling what you may call quote-unquote survival kits, which typically include a small camping cooker, matches, water containers, blankets, and first aid kits. And these are good things to have at home, but the kits themselves are usually very overpriced. And in the ad, they often reference MSB to make it appear as it has been endorsed by the agency. Another product that is very commonly marketed is a radio, which is powered by a manual crank, typically priced at 70 euros or above. And MSB says that this is a totally unnecessary item to have. It's not even very practical, most cases, they say. If you want to make sure that you can listen to the radio in a power outage, it's much easier, much simpler, much cheaper to just buy a cheap battery-powered radio and have a stash of batteries available at mm-hmm. home. So what you should have at home, they say, is a plan so that you can survive for 7 days without power or going to the store. That's what you should plan for. And they say, make a plan to provide water, food, communication, and heating in your home for 7 days. So that's basically what, that's reasonable to do. But don't buy these hand-cranked radios.
Mm-hmm.
Another good idea, of course, is to have a rotating supply of dry products like rice, pasta, cereal, things like that, combined with some tinned products. Stay away from these very expensive survival kits. They are mostly a marketing ploy.
Mm. Okay, sticking to things that are...
That make us depressed, yeah.
That make us depressed and that are difficult to crack, really, and to make sense of, are things when, for example, high-profile person dies, all kinds of rumors start to spread, and especially when those rumors are based on investigations and the knowledge of previous cases where, well, those kinds of conspiracies turned out to be real. And one of those people, one of these high-profile people, is a Russian, well, Ukrainian-Russian guy, Alexei Anatolievich Navalny, who died a couple of days ago on the 16th of February. So for those who are not familiar with the name, he was an opposition leader. By opposition, we mean Putin's opposition.
Mm.
And he was a very successful politician and public figure, drawing the public's attention to a lot of very serious issues in Russia, including corruption and democracy deficits and all that. He was a lawyer by training. And he was also a political prisoner. So by political prisoner, we mean that several international organizations deemed his imprisonment, several of them actually, politically motivated. Even though he was imprisoned and suspended, well, he was sentenced to prison for embezzlement. Actually, in several investigations turned out to show that that was not really substantiated. However, when he unveiled a couple of corruption cases by high-profile Russian politicians, he was, well, kind of pulling the wrong threads. So he things that he shouldn't have done. So much so that in 2020, he was a victim of attempted murder by poisoning. His poisoning case was known all over the world, and there were international organizations, independent authorities as well, and it turned out that there were high-profile Russian politicians linked to his poisoning back in 2020. He recovered from that poisoning, but by the time all that happened, he was already doing his prison term. And he was moved from prison to prison. There was another case when he got into some health issues that were not allowed to be investigated by international organizations in Russia. So that raised a bit of a suspicion. And now in February 2024, he died in a remote place where nobody even had known that he had been transferred to. That was a place in Siberia, a prison camp. And he collapsed and died of an unknown cause. So that raised a lot of suspicion from international organizations and even government. Like some governments across the globe have issued not only concerns that it might have been the wrongdoings of Putin's government, because he was an outspoken critic of the war in Ukraine and the motivation for that, but also some governments even outright accused Putin of killing Navalny, one of his greatest arch enemies. So that's a difficult situation to be in. However, it can be made even worse by news outlets and social media posts. Some of them have been suggesting that Navalny was not dying of natural causes or just a sudden heart failure or something. We don't know what the real cause of his death was, but some suggest that it was COVID vaccine, because the mRNA vaccine was he was administered. And it's so shameful that everyone blames it on Putin while he was just overdosing on the mRNA vaccine. And no wonder he died of a blood clot. So there are several things that are wrong about that. First of all, he probably never got the COVID-19 vaccine, the mRNA vaccine, because it was never allowed to happen in Russia. And by that time, he was already imprisoned. So he could have no access to that either of the mRNA vaccines. That's one problem with this. The other thing is that we don't know what the cause of his death was. So claiming that it was a blood clot that killed him caused by an mRNA vaccine, it's doubly unfounded. This is just something that shows how impossible to know anything about this case is, and that gives a head-scratching issue for all kinds of skeptics out there, because obviously we would like to believe, as humans, we would like to believe that Putin could have done that, right? And he wanted to stop him, he wanted to get rid of him for good, and, well, let's just be honest, it's not beyond Putin to do something like that. We have seen that happen in the last couple of years, so we don't know. But without evidence, we should not jump into conclusions like that. And I would like some of those European countries that claim that it actually happened already and it was because of Putin's action to refrain from those. Please don't base your stance on unsubstantiated claims. On the other hand, there is a possibility, and not a slim one as well, that these blog posts and these X posts on the platform that was previously known as Twitter, those can be generated by bots. And we have covered that 2 weeks ago on the show, that this has been known to happen. So we don't know. We should be careful when it comes to jump to conclusions. And please don't do that. So we don't know how he died. It's unfortunate that he died, because he was a great force of nature that went against everything that Putin does. And we need those people. But the correct thing to say about this is that we don't know. And we probably won't even know it at all, because the authorities, the Russian authorities, will not release the findings.
Very hard to find out, yeah. But not unlikely, though.
It just adds to the rumors. Yeah, and it adds to the speculations and adds to this notion that it might be because of them. Yeah.
Okay, so let's leave politics for a while and talk about
some
science.
Science, please.
Listeners may have seen a news item last week about so-called ultra-processed food. It made the rounds in all the big news outlets, I think. And in The Guardian, the header was, quote, "Ultra-processed food linked to 32 harmful effects to health, review finds," end quote. And the Guardian goes on to say, quote, "Ultra-processed food, UPF, is directly linked to 32 harmful effects to health, including a higher risk of heart disease, cancer, type 2 diabetes, adverse mental health, and early death, according to the world's largest review of its kind," end quote. That sounds very convincing and final. But I would imagine that a lot of our listeners are pretty scientifically savvy, and you may have to think a little bit about that. Of course, many people, especially the general public, will easily see this as very conclusive. This is new research that proves how bad this kind of food is. And don't get me wrong, I am no nutritionist, but there's no secret or doubt in my mind that fast food, snacks, and other heavily processed food may be and can be and probably are bad for you. That's not the problem here. They contain too much sugar, fats, and salt, and it's also very easy to overeat on them because they are intentionally made to be as tasty as possible using the cheapest ingredients. So I'm not a big fan. They're not designed to be healthy. They are designed to be desirable and profitable. However, we should also look critically at the science behind this. It is easy to confuse the publication in the BMJ, which is what prompted this news item, with new research and findings. The article published is a review of earlier research and even meta-studies, and it does in itself not present new data. And there are problems with a review like this. First of all, different studies may use different definitions. So that in turn may result in either that you have to select only the studies that use the same definitions, which excludes a lot of the data, or you include all of it and you risk trying to aggregate numbers which perhaps are not comparable. The other thing is that this review includes both meta studies and the original studies. And this may by mistake mean that a certain study could be included twice, first in itself and then as part of a meta study.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that they try to control for this, but it could happen by mistake. Then there is a selection bias in which studies are published, and per definition, this review cannot include studies that have not been published, right? And it's good, of course, if a study has been rejected, then you shouldn't include it. But we know that negative studies, studies that didn't find a connection, are very less often published. They're just not accepted because they didn't show anything in the heads of the people who are running the magazines. But they did actually show something. They showed that we couldn't find a connection and that, you know, that those studies tend not to be published as much. So this is called the file drawer effect. And yeah. We can suspect in this case that there are studies that were conducted but never got published because they didn't find a problem with ultra-processed food. Apart from this, I personally have always felt a little bit uncomfortable with the term ultra-processed foods because it is so wide and in itself it sounds bad. It's not a neutral name. And also, it includes a lot of things. Can you really group hamburgers, pizza, and fizzy drinks into one category? Clearly, they are different in their nature. So, yeah, take it for what it is. And I do believe that there's a lot of fast food out there that you should be careful with. I think it's okay to have a pizza once in a while, but don't make that your main food source. It is clear that we live in an age when it's much too easy to consume too many calories overall. And in unrelated news, or actually in related news, I should say, it was announced last week that over 1 billion people in the world now are considered obese, which is a big health problem. And it, to a large extent, that is due to these calories being available in a way that wasn't the case before. So we have to take this seriously, but I wish that the reporting on ultra-processed food was a little bit more nuanced sometimes, at least.
Yeah, but when you try to grasp so much in one statement, you cannot avoid that. Yeah, I have the same problems with these. One of them is there are certain variables that are not controlled for. Like, for example, it could be that what causes harm is the high energy density. And as far as I know, that was not even one of the variables that were looked for. So when it's overly dense energy-wise, you take in a lot of energy without the nutrients, without enough of the good stuff as well. And the other thing is that we should, when we make these kind of statements that these are harmful and this is now established because of the review and all that, we need to work on a mechanism as well. We need to know what the reason for these might be because there can be a plausibility issue as well. There are certain claims that might not even sound plausible at first. So you have to be absolutely sure that there is an effect that you have to explain with a plausible mechanism. You can tweak the results. There are things, there are techniques that are frequently used to find even the tiniest effect there. And the tinier the effect, a large review may still show something, but the tinier that effect, the less significant it is, the more important it is for you to come up with a plausible explanation as the background mechanism. This is where evidence-based medicine is different from science-based medicine, for example.
I want to repeat what I said before, that you clump different things together. So in this review, they talk about fizzy drinks, quote-unquote. Yeah. But I'm sure that they mean both normal Coca-Cola, which has a lot of sugar in it, and Diet Coke, which has no sugar in it. And they may both be bad. I'm not saying that they are good for you.
Yeah, but for different reasons.
Bad for you. But they are, they are not the same because they are almost the opposite then. So you can't just treat them as the same thing.
Exactly. And carbonated water is a fizzy drink as well.
Yeah, sure. So be careful when you interpret all these reviews.
It can be very difficult. So this is why, but reviews are important. And when it comes to healthcare, they become even more important because those are the real things that can show you an effect. And when it comes to treatments, that effect needs to be there because you don't want to administer a drug that is ineffective. So you want an effect to be there and you have to be able to show that. But other health effects are important to know like that with that kind of depth as well. This is why organizations like Cochrane, which is a British-founded organization with a charitable organization with local geographical groups in 130 countries. Amazing stuff. It's mostly voluntary-based. Like, according to Wikipedia, they work with 30,000 volunteer experts all around the world. What they do, there is something that is called the Cochrane Library. And the Cochrane Library, it's named after the founder of it, Archie Cochrane, who was a Scottish physician, by the way. So that is a collection of databases of all kinds of reviews, meta-analyses and systematic reviews that are considered the highest level of evidence when it comes to healthcare. And this is very important because they not only collect all those reviews, but also they are the ones to disseminate the results coming from those reviews. So they make an effort into communicating the results and making them accessible to the lay people as well out there, who don't necessarily understand or read reviews on their bedside. So it's like it's before going to sleep. Not everyone does that. So this is why it's important for disseminators of that kind of knowledge to work as well. Now, the geographical groups in certain countries work with different funding schemes. So there are those that are completely funded by donations and not organizations or large-scale organizations. And in some countries, government organizations or government bodies are involved in the funding of that kind of work that they do as well. One of these countries is the UK. And in the UK, the National Institute for Health and Care Research was the main body funding the work that Cochrane UK did up until now. The Cochrane UK was hosted by the Oxford University Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust. And unfortunately, because of all the government funding cuts in March 2024, this funding comes to an end. And that unfortunately means that one of the major branches of Cochrane, Cochrane UK, will close down. A couple of months ago, they were still on the lookout for other funding opportunities, and they issued a call for private fundings and donations, but unfortunately, they didn't receive enough, so they decided to close shop. And that's very unfortunate, because bodies like this and organizations like this are absolutely necessary for a better future and a better healthcare. And especially with all that nonsense and pseudoscience and falsehoods out there, we need these reviews to be collected and published as well. And there is a victim of this unfortunate line of events as well, another victim that is evidently Cochrane. We occasionally used stuff that were published there, and that is a blog that was basically run by Cochrane UK as well. And in the more than 11 years that they have been running, they published 700 blog posts, and they found all kinds of different ways of communicating the scientific background of their library items. So I'd like to thank Sarah Chapman and Selina Ryan Vig for their huge efforts at disseminating all that kind of knowledge. And that is very unfortunate that they are going.
Yeah.
So let's keep other local branches and geographic groups of Cochrane alive and kicking, please, because we need them.
Yeah, right.
All right. So that is very unfortunate. I would like to give the UK government a really wrong award. So can we do that for this or anything else?
We could certainly do that, Anders. But maybe for something else, we will see. Because, and I'll tell you the backstory, the UK government is considering discontinuing the publication of vital statistics on deaths of homeless people as part of a broader view of mortality statistics. These statistics, published by the Office for National Statistics in England and Wales and the National Records for Scotland, provide insights into the number of recorded deaths among the homeless population, including details like age, sex, and cause of death. And until recently, the UK government did not track homeless deaths, but it changed in 2018. The current data is the most accurate that is available. It faces limitations like unreliable coroner's reports or lack of a specific question about homelessness on death certificates. The lack of data on homelessness reflects a broader issue of invisibility for homeless populations. The methods of counting them are imperfect, and many homeless individuals do not seek help from local authorities. So we don't really have a good way to count these numbers. It's really important that these issues are addressed because affordable housing becomes scarcer and evictions rise. So this is increasingly important, and the UK government then not taking responsibility for tackling this issue, but discontinuing these statistics is really bad. It's an inadequate response. It won't help public awareness, and it's also morally wrong. So,
what we don't know doesn't hurt us, right?
It's like see no evil, speak no evil.
Yeah, but it's hard to think that there's not the political motivation behind this.
Exactly.
They don't want to publish the numbers. It's not that they will save a lot of money, I guess, from not collecting the statistics. It's just that it looks bad, so we won't publish it.
And the ridiculous thing is that they claim it's because of technical reasons, because the calculations for these statistics are experimental or something like that. That was the rationale behind that, it needs further development before it can be continued. Fuck off. You work with this until you can come up with better ways to improve
the running system,
the
not
method.
Abolish it.
And you know where I heard the same thing? When in 2015, the government stopped publishing data on people living under the poverty line.
In Hungary.
Mm. In Hungary. The Hungarian government of Orbán did the same thing in 2015. And never since that have we seen any official statistics on people living under the poverty line.
Was never seen again.
Mm. Yep. So they don't exist, apparently.
Yeah, and it's like, I've even got a quote for you from the article. Because they say, ceasing to track and publish data on homeless deaths not only obscures the true scale of the issue, but also undermines our ability to address the systemic factors driving homelessness and prevent further tragedies.
Exactly.
Yeah, it won't help the issue. Not at all.
No. No, it will cover it. It will basically look like there is no issue.
So the UK government did get the prize for being really wrong, or it will get it, but for another reason than you thought.
Well, there are many reasons,
For putting makeup on their statistics and changing a system that was one of the only ways to help people in need, the UK government receives this week's prize for being really wrong.
Yeah.
Mm. And that is a potential issue that Jonathan Pye would cover, I think. When he hears about this from our podcast, because I'm pretty sure that he doesn't know it from anywhere else, he will definitely go on a rant about this. Yeah,
Jonathan, you heard it here first.
Okay, so yeah, it's definitely a well-deserved, really wrong award.
Indeed.
Well,
thank you.
I would add the unfunding the Cochrane UK Geographic Group as well for the reason. But I think this is reason enough in and of itself. All right. So, but that brings us to the end of this week's show, which is usually marked by a quote. So do we have one, Annika?
Yes, it is a quote. And it's a quote by acclaimed Professor Edzard Ernst, who we all know and appreciate. And he wrote this quote in A Scientist in Wonderland, a memoir of searching for truth and finding trouble, a book that is also in my bookcase. Probably in your guys' bookcases too, because...
Exactly.
He's just a staple of skeptical literature and continues to produce awesome works. And this quote is not short and sweet, but it is sweet, and it goes like this. Alternative medicine had begun its remarkable ascent in a general climate of unreason. Incrementally, over the past two decades, we have seen the emergence of a culture that is curiously indifferent to the concept of truth. There is not one truth now, but many, all of them interchangeable, all of them of equal weight, and all deserving of equal consideration. In this wonderland of relative facts, parallel truth, and intellectual legerdemain, basing an argument on flawed reasoning does not automatically disqualify or even devalue it. To the contrary, logical fallacies are tolerated, indeed often celebrated, as manifestations of a much-needed diversity. End quote.
Ah, all right.
Food for thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we do live in that world. But fortunately, there are lots of people trying to make that change.
Yeah.
And we will continue reporting on things that are happening around that realm. And we are, in our small and insignificant ways, trying to do the same thing. So, for that, and for joining me today on this episode, I'd like to thank both of you, Annika and Pontus.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Many, many thanks to our listeners as well for tuning in. Please keep doing so. And until next week, goodbye.
Tschüss.
Hej då.
Vi slatt.
This has been your ESP experience. The show is produced and recorded by the ESP.eu. Join us again next time, but until then, please send your feedback, comments, or death threats to info@theesp.eu. We would also love to hear your ideas and suggestions regarding future episodes, as well as news from your country of residence that might interest others across the continent. If you have a local event or organization to promote, please don't hesitate to let us know, as we are more than happy to help. All music in the program was written and performed by Keisha J. Gray and George Schwab and is used with their permission. Please check out our webpage at www.theesp.eu, follow us on Twitter at espodcast_eu, and like us on Facebook. I don't know how you can believe.
Tridentus, Tridentinosaurus antiquus.
Including, Copernicus.
Tycho Brahe?
No. Tycho Brahe's successor, Kepler. So, okay. Including Johannes Kepler.
So that sounds very authoritative.
Authoritative.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That sounds very convincing. So, and final.
In this wonderland of relative facts, parallel truth, and intellectual... What? Sorry, I didn't even look that work up. Legerdemain? Sorry, just have to quickly look
Legerdemain? That up. Legerdemain? Is that a word?
Somehow reminds me of Deborah Hyde, but that's probably another word.
Okay.
Jourdemain.
Okay.